Hello and welcome to the July 2026 ISB podcast. I'm Linda Mizon Hutter, and at the moment, I'm not only the vice chair, but the acting chair in this interim period. So welcome. And Zach, why don't you introduce yourself?
So I'm Zach Est. I'm also a member of the ISB. I'm here today to discuss the six projects or five of the six projects that we covered in this month's board meeting. We'll be covering in particular the statement of cash flows, intangible assets, the PIR of IFRS 16, the presentation of particular tax charges, and the BCDGI project.
Okay, so let's kick it off with the statement of cash flows. And just to remind everybody, this project was actually added to our pipeline as a result of the third agenda consultation, which was done some time ago, but there was very strong demand from our stakeholders, and we were finally able to launch that recently. Now, when we set out, we set some objectives for this project, and in particular, we're looking for ways to improve the requirements that exist today in IAS 7. So those objectives were to strengthen the link between the statement of cash flows and the other parts of the financial statements, and to specify the content and location of information about non-cash transactions. Now, one of the first questions I get from people who don't do the preparation of these statements is why on the statement of cash flows, we're talking about non-cash transactions. So Zach, in a moment, is going to explain that. So stay tuned. Our next objective was to extend the management-defined performance measure requirements in IFRS 18 to include certain cash flow measures, so we're considering that, and to improve the consistent application of the requirements for the classification of cash flows and the definition of cash equivalents, which is always a very interesting discussion. So, Zach, over to you on non-cash transactions.
Perfect. Well, I will start with some of the current requirements, which is that non-cash transactions, not surprisingly, are excluded from the cash flow statement. The information is disclosed elsewhere in the financial statements. And when we talked to investors, some of the feedback we heard was that as finance and accounting has gotten more complex, these non-cash transactions have become more important to them because you can essentially replicate any cash transaction with a non-cash transaction today. So for example, leases would replace borrowing and building something, or they would say that the information may be available, but it's difficult for them to pull it together comprehensively. So our aim was to increase the transparency in this project and make that information easier to access and use. And we've done that by trying to build on some existing good practices that are out there and improve them through testing with investors, preparers, and consultative groups. And when we got to the July meeting, we tentatively decided to add, in terms of doing that, some application guidance around the scope of what transactions would be included. We also looked at a disclosure objective where we were going to try to help investors understand how non-cash transactions contribute to changes in related assets, liabilities, and equity. Another key point was the board decided that this information should be in a single note. It should be aggregated by the type of transaction, identifying the related activities in the statement of cash flows, and shown alongside similar cash transactions. And finally, we require presentation in a structured format, which isn't always a given. For example, we require a table as one way you could do it. As always, there was a lot of discussion around balancing costs and benefits, and the board was cognizant in its discussion that feedback was mixed, but an exposure draft was seen as our best opportunity to really gather feedback and test the proposals that we heard.
Thanks, Zach. I think that's really helpful because if we really put it down to plain English, this notion about non-cash is really interesting because what you're trying to do is give investors comparable information so that they can do the math themselves. So if one entity in your example decides to borrow money and build something, but the other entity decides to lease the same kind of asset, you want to put them on an equal footing. And I think that's important for our stakeholders to know. Agreed?
Exactly.
Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about something near and dear to my past life, which is about the statement of cash flows for financial institutions. So we kicked off the discussion on this topic this month, and it is a really important part of this project. Now, our staff has done some research and stakeholder outreach, and the results of that were very consistent with earlier findings that there's limited use of the statement of cash flows for financial institution. And that's probably largely linked to the business models of financial institution, because there's the relationship between cash flows and performance is less clear for banks and insurers. First of all, banks and insurers hold customer cash. So that's one element there. But secondly, the metrics really used to evaluate the strength of the bank or the insurer is more like, you know, capital levels, liquidity measures, solvency measures. And so the statement of cash flows isn't necessarily the most relevant statement when users look at those financial statements. But what we also learned is there's still some specific items that they want to know and they're very useful. So for instance, interest or dividends received and paid, very important information. How they've raised capital is very important. Whether they've done share buybacks is very important. Any options that have been exercised, all of those things are really important, and users want to have that information. So we listened to the staff and we heard their plan to focus the future work on identifying and preserving these items that are useful to users while avoiding the requirements for financial institutions to provide information that's not considered useful by doing necessarily the statement of cash flows. And this will be done alongside work that we asked them to do on identifying which entities would be within the scope of any potential changes. We also took some time to discuss the information the staff referenced in their papers on the FASB's project on the statement of cash flows, because they're also examining similar issues for financial institutions. And if you were able to listen to any of the output from the educational meeting we had with the FASB in June, we talked to the FASB about this very matter. And we also talked to our consultative groups, for instance, ASAF and EEG. Now, given the overlap with the FASB work, the IASB staff will continue to engage regularly with the FASB counterparts as the projects develop. And from a next steps perspective, we're going to continue assessing the potential improvements across the project plan topics. And in the second half, you can expect further discussions on specified line items in the statement of cash flows, again, non-cash changes in working capital, cash equivalents, and the classification of cash flows. Azette, can I turn it over to you to introduce the discussion on intangible assets?
Absolutely. So as a reminder, this is a project that came out of the agenda consultation with really two main objectives as decided by the board. One was to improve the usefulness of the information entities provide about intangible items in their financial statements. And the second was to update IAS 38, which is an older standard, and particularly to make it more suitable for newer types of intangible assets and new ways of using them. And that was important because this is a really large project. The world has evolved a ton since IAS 38 came out, and a lot of it is seen as being not fitting. Given the size, though, we needed to start the project in a very comprehensive way, but by focusing on a couple key areas up front. And so the board decided on two streams of work that would take place. The first was to really look closely at user information needs and understand what they weren't getting today that they would like to get in the future. And then also to take a look at the definition and recognition requirements in IAS 38 using a couple test cases. And we've already carried out extensive research. So the team's been working on this for most of the year. And we were actually able to discuss the findings on user information needs in May. So this July meeting brought us to the first of the test cases we're looking at.
Yeah, I think it's important for everybody to remember that we're using these test cases not to figure out necessarily the accounting initially for the two test cases, but to explore what kinds of questions come up when we think about these two test cases, to give us some real live examples of things that we might consider in terms of updating IAS 38. So that's the linkage with the test cases. So we started the discussions on the workstream exploring the potential changes to the definition in terms of the intangible asset and the recognition requirements of intangible assets. We had our first discussion of the model the staff have been developing using the software as a service test case. And it's important to understand that when IAS 38 was written, agreements like software as a service didn't exist. And so that's why this is a really important test case. And to think about this in ways that we would develop principle-based solutions in our next steps. So the focus for this month was looking at the model for customer accounting in intellectual property licensing contracts. And the staff started out by exploring a pretty basic fact pattern in the software as a service models. So what the model focused on first, what is the underlying item? Second, what rights does the customer obtain for that underlying item? And third, do those rights actually represent an asset? And one of the points I want to make here is that we know what users have told us is they don't really want us to load up the balance sheet with new items for intangible assets. But if these items actually are assets, we're going to have to consider whether or not they should be recognized, whether or not they can be reliably measured, so that as a standard setter, we still have to take that step to make sure we understand what we should be doing in terms of our approach. Now, from a next steps perspective, when we think about future meetings, we are going to consider the accounting treatment for recognition, measurement, disclosure, et cetera, and the effect of any embedded services and more complex software as a service variations. We're also going to look at our second test case, which is agile software development, including how to update current recognition requirements to make them more suitable for more modern development practices, and how to determine the unit of account for initial recognition, if any. And then to consider the implications, we're also going to move on to looking at more traditional intangible assets and then group that all together. And we hope to discuss these remaining topics through the second half of the current year. And we'll be obviously on a regular basis consulting with the ISB's consultative groups in the second half of the year. And our plan is to make board decisions on the IAS 38 improvements in early 2027. So stay tuned for those. So Zach, can we move on to the PIR of IFRS 16?
We can, because amazingly, we've only gone through two of the five topics. So the post-implementation review of IFRS 16, which covers lease accounting, the IFRS 16 went effective in 2019, and it essentially requires lessees to recognize assets and liabilities for almost all leases. And the purpose of this PIR and all PIRs is to assess whether the standard is working as intended and meeting our objectives. So to date, we've been able to discuss feedback on the RFI, and over the last several months, we've made a number of important tentative decisions. So first, thank you to the stakeholders who've provided so much feedback. This is one where we certainly saw more polarized opinions than we had in previous PIRs. But we've been able to get to the point where we could take those tentative decisions and move forward. So maybe I'll hand it to you to discuss those final decisions.
Great, thanks. And we had a good discussion in the July meeting, and we were able to conclude that IFRS 16 is indeed overall working as intended, and we had wide agreement from our stakeholders on that. And in general, we got positive feedback. And there's very little appetite for us to make any fundamental changes to IFRS 16. And we also were able to agree that sufficient work was completed to conclude this part of the review. Now, we finalized our previous tentative decisions. So number one, we're adding a project that will explore how to reduce ongoing costs of IFRS 16. And most of those are related to remeasurements of the lease liability over time, and also discount rates. And whenever you get discussing discount rates, you have a complex discussion. And so that one's important too. But we want to make sure we do that in a way that doesn't significantly affect or have a negative impact on the usefulness of the resulting information for the users of our financial statements. We're also talking about a probably relatively narrow scope project that could be undertaken together with the earlier one I just mentioned to clarify how a lessee applies the requirements in IFRS 16 and IFRS 9 financial instruments to account for a particular rent concession. As soon as you involve two of our standards together, you know that you have a little bit more complex analysis to do in terms of how to do that. We also want to strengthen the requirement for lessees to disclose total cash outflow for leases. And this actually, we're going to connect with one of the earlier projects we discussed to the Statement of Cash Flows project and see how those two project teams can work together on that. And we're going to consider the priority of a corporate wrapper matter, the sale and leaseback of assets in a single asset entity. And again, this is IFRS 16, and this time with IFRS 10, together with other corporate wrapper matters. And that's probably going to flow into our next agenda consultation. But we hope to publish the project summary for the PIR of IFRS 16 in the fourth quarter of this year. Over to you, Zach.
Okay, so I think next we'll move on to the presentation of particular tax charges. And this was a topic that related to the presentation of these particular tax charges that was submitted to our Interpretations Committee. And the Interpretations Committee had a long discussion, and what they decided was that under IFRS 18, an entity is not allowed to classify taxes or charges that are not income taxes under IS 12 in the income taxes category. That being said, they did receive a lot of feedback with stakeholder concerns that this would not reflect the economic substance, it wouldn't provide useful information, and it would actually reduce comparability with income taxes in some cases. And I think this was a reflection in their minds that IS 12 is a relatively old standard and the world has changed and broadened. And as we all know, taxation has gotten a lot more complex for corporates and our personal lives. So the committee acknowledged the concerns that they got and reported them to the ISB. And in May, the ISB decided to explore amending IFRS 18. So working from that May decision, we actually had a discussion last month where the staff presented a solution that would have used cover taxes under OECD's Pillar 2 model rules. Ultimately, the board came back to the technical staff and decided to ask them to explore alternative measures. That one probably didn't work in the mind of most of the board members. And that brings us to July's meeting.
Yeah, we had a really good discussion, I thought, in July on this matter, and we were able to consider some different approaches. Ultimately, we agreed with the staff recommendation to propose a more principles-based approach that would require an entity to classify in the income taxes category tax charges imposed by a government as a direct substitute for income taxes as defined by IAS 12. Now, this would apply only when legislation specifies that an entity pays either an income tax, again under IAS 12, or the specified tax charge. We also decided to propose other related amendments to IFRS 18, including requiring disaggregation of and disclosure about the tax charges classified in the income taxes category. So as next steps, we're going to have a future discussion of transition and effective date. What, if anything, flows through to IFRS 19, our reduced disclosure standard. And we also need to make sure we met all of our due process requirements. And we fully expect to publish this exposure draft in Q4 of this year. So, Zach, I'm going to turn the next project completely over to you.
Okay. So this is the last one for our discussion. It's Business Combinations, Disclosures, Goodwill, and Impairment, the mouthful project. And here the objective is to improve the information companies provide to investors about business combinations at a reasonable cost. So in May, we had a really pivotal moment. We'd made a lot of tentative decisions along the way in this disclosure project, disclosure portion of the project. And the staff presented finally an overall package of initial and subsequent disclosures that an entity would make about performance after a business combination. And in that session, 7 out of the 13 board members voted that the benefits of the overall package and expected synergy disclosures would justify the costs. There were some concerns, though, and I think that's why we ended up with the vote we did. So just to go through the big ones, there was some concern that the information was outside the scope of financial statements in terms of being forward-looking. There were also concerns about auditability and how that information would be received, so an expectations gap associated with auditability as well. There was concern about the number of entities that would actually report subsequent performance information and whether it would be too limited. And finally, I would say there was some concerns expressed about the completeness or framing of the subsequent performance information based on the smaller decisions we'd made. So with that, the board asked the staff to come back this month and think about an updated package. And they did that. And it was a little bit bigger change than I think a lot of the board members expected. What they did was they removed the acquisition date targets and expected synergy information. So this substantially addressed the concerns about commercial sensitivity, litigation risk, auditability, the expectations gap, and forward-looking information. The result is that we saw a shift in the focus to subsequent performance information, where they also removed the threshold. So the number of entities that would have to consider whether to provide that and be subject to the other considerations was expanded. And what that let the team do was also remove the exemptions, which greatly simplified some of the requirements because they no longer had to worry about things like commercial sensitivity that were driving some of the exemptions. So this month, we had a really intense discussion. I think it was a pleasure to watch for most people and consider about the updated package and whether that could improve financial reporting. There was also a deep discussion about how the subsequent performance information might be improved to provide better information to users. So the result is that the staff are going to go back once again and explore two approaches for subsequent performance information. One of those approaches would be to not restrict the subsequent performance information an entity would be required to disclose to only information measured in currency units. That was one of the sort of reductions that took place in the May package. The second was to consider whether an entity would just report on specified metrics for disclosure. For example, requiring all entities to disclose revenue and operating profit from a business combination for a specified period of time after the business combination. So we're looking forward to them coming back sometime after the summer and reviewing what they come back with.
Yes, I think you can look forward to continued deliberations. And while I said I was going to leave it to you, Zach, I can't help one editorial comment because some of our stakeholders are getting a little frustrated with us in terms of whether we're going to finish this project or not and when we're going to finish it. And I understand that. But what was interesting to me as I was chairing that particular discussion, which I thought was a great discussion and a really interesting discussion, was as people talked, we were building more consensus in terms of things we could look at and we could consider. And I think that's a promising sign for us in terms of focusing on trying to get to the finish line with this project. So I think that's all very good. So at this point, I just want to thank all of you for listening. Obviously, we look forward to future updates. We don't have a board meeting in August, so you can all take a bit of a break, but we will be back in September with our next episode. So for now, goodbye from the IASB.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take the time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Please contact us on communications@ifrs.org with any questions, comments, or suggestions. You can also sign up for email alerts on our website, ifrs.org, or find us on social media.